Now for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
I don't know if I've shared this story with you again. I mean, how often do we repeat stories? Well, probably a lot, and I hope this is not necessarily a repeat, but I've told you privately or mentioned it in some fashion, then I just felt it fit a little bit with the message today that was my message at the feast, because I think it's appropriate after the feast to give this message as well. But last year, while I was driving with my daughter Lindsay, maybe I did tell you the story, driving with Lindsay, and she had to do some errands and going to Safeway, and had Haley in the back, who's 3 years old. My daughter, of course, is 29. And as we were on the way back home, this song came on the radio that I've always felt since it came out. It had just come out only a few weeks when we had this experience. And so I was there taking my daughter, and this song is reminiscent of some of the things that we did together as father and daughter. And it's the times in which, as a father and daughter, or, you know, mother and son, father, son, whatever, there are times in life that you look back on and you realize that there was more to that activity than just the activity, the 50 minutes or an hour and a half or 2 hours that you spent on a hike or a camping trip, or, you know, you did this or that, or you went on a field trip. And I was kind of the designated father that would go on the field trips in elementary school with my daughter. And I thought, as this song came on, I thought about all those times and those moments when she was 4, she was 7 or 12 or 15. And this song struck me in that way. And it's a song by Trace Adkins called Just Fishin'. And you may have heard it, you may not have. I'd play it, but it breaks copyright rules to record it while you're recording a message, so I won't do that. But I'll read some of the lyrics, not as beautifully as Trace Adkins sings them, but it's entitled Just Fishing. Or, you know, country stars can mangle the English language with no problem whatever, so you'll hear it. This is Just Fishing, no G. I'm lost in her there holding that pink rod and reel. She's doing almost everything but sitting still, talking about her ballet shoes and training wheels and her kittens. And she thinks we're just fishing. I say, Daddy loves you, baby, one more time. And she says, I know. I think I've got a bite. And all this laughing, crying, smiling, dying here inside's what I call living. And she thinks we're just fishing on the riverside, throwing back what we could fry, drowning worms and killing time, nothing too ambitious. She ain't, country stars can sing ain't very well. She ain't even thinking about what's really going on right now, but I guarantee this memory's a biggin', and she thinks we're just fishing. That's the essence of the song, that there's always something that happens in an activity that's much greater, especially with your kids, it's much greater than just what is happening at this particular time. Now, there's another song for boys as well, and I'll get to that one. So we're listening. I'm asking my daughter to listen to this song, hoping it will touch her emotionally as it has touched me. And by the time the song ends and the chorus repeats itself, and she thinks we're just fishing, and then he ends with, this isn't just fishing. We're not just fishing. By that time, I'm kind of an emotional wreck, although I'm trying to maintain, you know, some control, holding onto the wheel and, you know, stability of some kind, you know, being the Rock of Gibraltar father that I always am. But I'm, you know, tears are just pouring down my cheeks at this point, you know, because I'm thinking about all those times when we did those kind of things, and she was little, and now she's big, and now she's got one that's little in the back seat, right? And I'm hoping that she'll see that connection and see that same kind of life and attitude. And I look over and I said, honey, did you hear that? And she says, I'm sorry, Dad, I was texting Jared. What was that again? Now my dentist tells me that he's good friends with Tracy Lawrence. And Tracy Lawrence is a favorite artist of mine, too. And he sang a song, or he wrote a song entitled Till I Was a Daddy, Too. Now, I hope that 20 years is enough time for the statute of limitations to reveal church things. Can I have an amen on that? I was the pastor 20 years ago here. My son at that time, well, maybe it was longer than 20 years ago. We were at the Jewish Community Center meeting. But let me read the lyrics of this verse, of this beginning of this song, sung by Tracy Lawrence. Do you recall, and then it's not in the lyric, but he says in his low, beautiful country voice, Daddy, when I was six, I got lost out in the woods and you worried yourself sick. What about the day I got in my first fight? Mama, she got mad, but you swelled up with pride. I never knew how deep a father's love could run until I had a son. So here's where the statute of limitations, I decree, has run out. We are meeting at the Jewish Community Center, and okay, maybe you want to stop the recording here in case some of the people that may be innocent now ever listen to this. Maybe they would never. I'm going to tell the story. I don't care. Let's just say that all children in the church aren't angels, right? And my kids aren't, but and this happened to a lot of kids in the church, not just my kids. There were some young men who thought it was very sporting and funny to come up to the back of other young guys' heads, little kids' head, and smack them on the back of the head and then run. And, of course, if you try to retaliate, then you're going to get caught and the deacons are going to haul you before the minister, in this case me. And, you know, that happened. But this happened to one of my sons. And it happened on a regular basis ever since we got here in 1988. It's one of those things where it's easy to overlook as the minister, because when you have a church of 300 or 350 people, then immediately when you come in the door, there's a deacon presenting you with announcements, and somebody's asking you about the special music, and you're having a conference later on with somebody else. My wife is left to fend for herself, and people are asking you questions and doing this and that. And even before services, a lot of this activity occurred. You know, I'm not saying I was oblivious to it. I knew that there was this group in the church that were, you know, the only reason you would call them bullies is that everybody else acquiesced to them. And it just was one of those things that happened on a regular basis. We kind of all live with it. So we're heading home in our ministerial minivan back on River Road. And the boys start telling me about what happened that Sabbath. They told me that these kids were picking on him. This one individual was picking on James and smacking him and then running away. And I pulled over and I shocked my wife. Okay, close your ears, all do-gooders. Don't listen, because this is what your church pastor said at the time. I pulled over and I looked back at James. He was 7 or 8. And I said, okay, if that happens next time and you don't do something to take care of it, I'm going to whip you when I get home. Terry said, we can't do that. We're in the ministry. I said, I don't care. James, you take care of it. So you remember the Jewish Community Center? They had a wall in the back and they had these names carved out in brass relief letters and everything. So it did happen the next week. James took care of it. He picked one of them up and rammed him into the back of that relief structure and everything. And guess what? He never got picked on again. I think a lot of times people have totally misapplied, don't understand, turn the other cheek, which I'll explain at another time. But does not mean be a pacifist. And it does not mean let people bully you around like that. But anyway, I was pretty happy about it. Now, Terry objected, and she will recognize, I think now, 20 years have passed, honey, you can forgive me. Over 20 years have passed, but there is something about a dad when he sees his son take up for himself, even if he gets beaten up, at least he's standing up for himself, and a man will understand that. But Tracy Lawrence's song goes on from talking about that to from watching him learn how to crawl to skinned up knees to from skateboard falls to praying he'd get through football alive, from hearing his first words spoken, the first time his heart got broken, and knowing soon he'll spread his wings and fly. I guess I didn't know what a daddy goes through till I was a daddy too. It's a beautiful song, but I realize that not everybody likes country music. There was a time when I didn't either. The fast pace of time goes racing from first grade to graduation, and knowing soon he'll spread his wings and fly. I guess I didn't know what a daddy goes through till I was a daddy too. So we talk about family a lot in the Church of God. And we talk a lot about, at the feast, through the years, we've talked a lot about the government of God, which is a phrase you won't find in the Bible. Now, you'll find instances of government, and if you'll turn to Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, there's a beautiful passage there that talks about the government of God, as we know. Now, we also realize that the family is the undergirding of all society. It doesn't matter how many laws or how good your system is. If you don't have strong families, then you're not going to have a strong world. And we realize that in the world tomorrow, that is going to be the undergirding of society, strong families, and they're going to be put back together. And I really count one of the greatest blessings of life is the fact that I've been able to learn a little bit about children by having them, and grandchildren as well, and seeing what goes on. And I have a great deal of respect for my children's grandparents and the wisdom they were able to impart to, you know, when my dad and mom were alive, the things that they were able to add to our children's life, and, you know, certainly to Terry's folks, the wisdom, the prestige and honor of their marriage and everything else that they were able to add to our kids, because they spent a lot of time, and they've always spent a lot of time with them. But most of us who are grandchildren, having grandchildren now, would have bypassed having children altogether and just gone on to the grandchildren, right? Because there's not as much responsibility. But like Tracy Lawrence and like Trace Atkins, you know, there are those experiences in life that we feel and we understand and you only learn about by doing. Now, like many of you who have been around the church for a long time, we've heard a lot of sermons about the government of God. Well, guess what? Government of God is not found in the Bible in that sense. Now, in this passage, it kind of is. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with justice, judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Now, I have heard, maybe you've heard in the past, that on the basis of this passage, our ministers say, God loves big government. Well, I don't think the citizens of the world tomorrow are going to be subject to an ever-growing bureaucratic nightmare of government in the human form like we're subject to in most governments in human society for 1,000 years. I don't think that's going to be the case. It's not a knock on big government in the world tomorrow. Obviously, the peace of God's kingdom is going to expand. It's going to get better and better, you know, as societies are changed, Satan's influence is removed, things are going to run much more smoothly, but the very basis of all of that is going to be the restoration of the family unit and family values based on the Ten Commandments. So most of us really don't know a lot about how government works, and especially in this day and age where you got a lot of backroom deals and you got a lot of favoritism and cronyism and all of that sort of thing. Somehow or another, our system continues despite its many failings. But the framers of our Constitution themselves had a certain amount of wisdom being subject to a monarchy and having thousands of years of experience to draw upon, realized that they would divide powers among three separate branches of government. They would have an executive branch that would carry out the administrative functions, and the top of that branch would be the president. They would have, the president wouldn't have absolute control. He wouldn't be an absolute monarch until now. He wouldn't be somebody that would subject his citizens to only his own desires until now. But he would be somebody that whose power would be checked by the other branches, the judicial branch and the legislative branch, which would come up with, and most of us learn this in civics class or in some kind of government class, and we understand that in our nation there is a division of powers that has basically served us fairly well. It's kind of, most of the time, it keeps things in check. It was a safeguard that they built. So you all understand that, but there are powers that are expressly given to each of those segments, and when one tries to get too powerful throughout history, let's put it that way, the other branches have tended to keep that one in line, and that's the way it was intended, because the framers of the Constitution knew that there was human nature, and there would always be this desire to, as in Christ's day, to be in control, to be in power, to become like a monarchy or a Roman government, an all-powerful that would rule its citizens. And we find within the American experiment one of the first times and only times in which the individual citizen's rights could be expressed and protected. Now, the encroachment recently in the last few years is that it's true our government does use some of its powers to spy on us, and we don't like it. We realize that any phone conversation can be taped. It can be evaluated by somebody in Utah in some big, huge building somewhere, and they do exist. We realize that our written communications, we think going over the internet, we think they're private, but they're not necessarily. They can be spied upon. But all of that aside, the best system of government has been within Jacob, has been within Israel. It's been here. We have some problems and difficulties at various times, but the divided responsibility for governing and leading in the most important aspects of a civil society were divided in three separate branches. So you had the division of power. And I think that most people can see or would concede that the Constitution of the United States has some biblical origins by individuals that believed in God. And again, the first government system that would provide for and guarantee the rights and freedoms extended to individuals. In Daniel 7 and verse 21, I'll ask you to turn there. Let me hasten to add that at no time in our history has our form of government been perfect. We've lived under, it's been better than a lot, though. I think you'd probably rather live under this system than a lot of others. But in Daniel 7 and verse 21, there is an interesting concept. Again, through the division of power expressed in the government, it's gone along pretty well for a few hundred years. What about you? What about what you have just celebrated, the Feast of Tabernacles and the thousand-year reign of Christ? Do you understand or do you realize the powers that God has invested in the saints? What powers has he invested in you to express throughout the thousand years, throughout the time of the millennium? Daniel 7 and in verse 21, it says, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. And a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom, to possess the kingdom. After the Feast of Trumpets and Christ's return, we will then possess the kingdom. What powers will God give to you, to me, to be exercised during that time? Because all other governments are going to be extinguished, as we know. The meaning of the vision is a little bit more clarified, that all systems of government are going to be judged, ruled, and eliminated. In verse 26, but the court shall be seated, And they shall take away his dominion, that is, this little horn, which has been a religious entity, also described in Revelation 13, a government of and by itself. They shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. No longer. Now, we have lived in peace, harmony, for the most part, for many years in our nation. It's not always going to be that way. Bible prophecy tells us that there is going to be a time of worldwide domination by a major power, to where it won't be the benevolent kind of dictatorship. Neither will it be kind of the benevolent power exercised by the United States. In most cases throughout history, we haven't asked for reparations from defeated nations. Europe did. We haven't, you know, demanded this and that as conditions of surrender, that or conditions of surrender haven't been so onerous that it has weakened that nation to where it would never revive again. In fact, through the Marshall Plan and many other plans after World War II and some through World War I, brought about some difficulties, actually sowed the seeds for World War II by some of the reparations that were demanded of the defeated powers, the Axis powers in World War I. But nonetheless, the United States really hasn't been a part of that for the most part. But the court shall be seated, they shall take his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. Amazing. Kind of struck me in a different way than I've ever read it before when I thought about kingdoms and our part in the world tomorrow, our part in the millennium. And I went back to thinking about Trace Atkins and Tracy Lawrence singing their songs about family. Because a lot of us, you know, have lived under, you know, the most beneficent government maybe in the history of mankind. And you still hear of abuses and the misuse of power and the application of power. But your turn is coming to exercise power and dominion in the next few years or decades or whenever that might be. God is investing all the power to govern within you. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So what will you be doing in the millennium? Do you realize the kind of power that has been invested in you already, just awaiting you and just awaiting Christ's return? Psalm 16 and verse 3, I'm going to speed up because if you'd like copies of this note, just send me an email or tell me afterwards. I'll print it out and send it to you because this is meant to go fast, okay? So this is meant to streamline it and go through. You know, some of you say, Mr. Buchanan, you talk too fast. You don't give us enough time to turn to the scriptures. Don't worry about that. You can have my notes, which are probably going to be better than your notes anyway, and then you can add to them. Well, I mean, my notes are going to be better than your notes because maybe they're not going to be better than your notes. Maybe you take better notes than I write the original sermon, and that's great. We'll add to it, okay? Psalm 16, I just meant that it would be a more accurate representation of what I'm actually saying. Whether what I'm saying is any good at all, you can be the judge on that. But Psalm 16 and verse 3 says, as for the saints who are on the earth, they are the excellent ones in whom is my delight. Why are they the excellent ones? Because they're part of God's family. When you think of government from the perspective of God, you might also associate the terminology with family. Because in a family, in a real, true family, now all of us have problems in our families, right? None of us come from perfect families. Am I right? But you've been in the church long enough to know that, Dad was wrong in that part. Mom, you know, she was off base, or she mistreated us here, or I got too many whippings as a kid, or my parents didn't really know about a family themselves, and, you know, they had one, and I was a part of it. Okay, I've heard all those stories, and I know them, and I do sympathize, and I realize that, you know, my family wasn't perfect. My growing up, my environment wasn't totally 100% godly, correct, or anything else. We can all relate to that. However, I'll bet there are a few good things that you can take and you've observed and watched and you've seen close families. Our job is to learn how to be great family members with one another in the kingdom of God. So although we can't really relate and we can't understand what goes on in Washington sometimes, and we can't understand the selfishness and the self-aggrandizement of politicians, one thing we can relate to is family. And when you think of power, when you think of government, when you think of all of that in the world tomorrow, the thousand-year reign, think of family and the way families ought to treat one another rather than the way they have in their mistakes and their problems. When you think of government from the perspective of God, think of family. You'd never treat a family member like governments sometimes treat their citizens. Ephesians 1 and verse 18, Paul said, "The eyes of your understanding being enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe according to the working of his mighty power." I think if there's difficulty in our understanding being enlightened, it may be because it sounds so too good to be true. It sounds too awesome and too all-encompassing and sounds like too much of an investment for God to make in little old me. I think that's one of the problems. I may be wrong, but I think that's one of the potential problems that all of us have, is that it is so difficult to grasp the vast powers that God is giving to the people that are seated next to you. Incredible stuff. And our understanding certainly should be enlightened when we come on the Sabbath day. Yes, even him. On the Sabbath day. On the Sabbath day and on the feasts. They joke with one another, so there's no problem. When you go to the Feast of Tabernacles or keep any holy day or keep the Sabbath, I hope that you come away with something a little bit better, you know, more mindful, helpful to you in understanding and being enlightened as to what God is doing with all of us. What is the exceeding greatness of his power to those of us who believe according to the working of his mighty power? In Ephesians 2 and verse 19, it says, "Now therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens." You could even say family members with the saints and members of the household of God. God is putting the finishing touches in these next few years, decades, or whatever it is till Christ returns. He's putting the finishing touches on his family, which is going to rule all of mankind, and all the governments are going to take all of that over, and it's all going to be given to them at his return. So what about you? Are you with it? Are you ready to go for that? I hope you are, because it's going to be like being a father or mother, a daughter, a son, in a family, maybe an uncle, but you are going to be in the family of God. And I'd like to show you three distinct areas where God has prepared power for you and what he is doing with you now in extending that power to you. First point of three, we are a temple. We're a temple. Ephesians 2 and verse 21 says, "In whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." The temple of God, the tabernacle, was changed to a temple because David was inspired, or he dreamt, and he was inspired to understand that God on this earth needed a more permanent dwelling place. Now, it wasn't permanent because it was made of stone and gold and silver and precious metals and all that sort of thing. So it wasn't permanent, but it was inspired by David to have that there as a symbol of where God would reside, in a temple. Now, they couldn't approach that God. They couldn't approach the eternal God, his, you know, and when the temple was dedicated, his presence filled in a symbolic way the temple into the Holy of Holies, and that's where there is a physical representation of where God dwells in eternity. He inhabits eternity, as Isaiah says. But nonetheless, that physical representation of the temple was needed so that there would be an opportunity for education of his law and the priests would be able to teach that from the temple. There would be this habitation symbolically for God. I don't know how the ancient Israelite felt about it or thought about it, but that was what the temple was for, as we understand. It was a focal point of teaching about God and His law, and it was necessary for that particular time. Not anymore. It's not necessary because God is building a temple within us, a habitation place for us as the forerunner to God dwelling with all mankind eternally, as shown in Revelation 21 and 22. God's habitation is with us. We are a temple. That is what God has empowered us with. Now, we don't have the exercise of that power now, but we're in preparation to become the focal point of the representation of the eternal to all of mankind through the millennium and the teaching that will be represented. You will be a teacher, as you've heard many times before. You will be a part of that temple which represents the teaching and the understanding and the planning of God and His plan for 1,000 years. And you're going to represent that to all of mankind. It's a great deal of responsibility and a great deal of power that God has invested in all of us, that you would understand the inheritance and glory of your calling. And that's what Paul said. Malachi 3 and verse 1 is an interesting passage. It has a lot of meanings. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. And we know that Revelation 19 shows that there's going to be a wedding supper. He's going to come to his temple. He's going to welcome all of the saints into the family and do whatever else is necessary in preparation for the overtaking of this world's governments. His family is going to do it. It's going to be a part of his people, his chosen ones, his selected, his anointed ones. Do you see yourself there as part of that temple that God is coming to? Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2, Paul emphasized the responsibility of being placed in the temple of God, which means that right now, throughout the week, every day, every minute of your life, you're in preparation for that time, the time of the millennium, the 1,000 years. You're in preparation always to rule, to govern, to teach during that time. It's a lot of power. Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? Yep, the saints are going to judge the world. That's what Daniel said in Daniel 7 and verse 26. The kingdoms of this world are going to be judged. Then they're going to be eliminated, demolished, and then they're going to be replaced by God. God's system, God's society, God's laws are going to prevail everywhere. I don't care where it is on this earth. People resist, they get no rain. You know, it's going to be, you know, the carrot and the stick kind of motivation. You know, well, most of us are used to the stick. Sometimes we haven't had much motivation in the terms of the carrot, you know, dangling out in front of us. This is the biggest carrot of all, dangling out in front of everybody. And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? We won't get into the ancillary meaning of the passage and what should be done in the church now. I'm not talking about that. Do you not know that we shall judge angels? Well, wait a minute. I thought the angels' fate was already sealed. Yeah, it is, kind of. But do you know that this word judge also means rule? It's the same Greek word that is translated rule. So the passage is saying that the saints, Paul is telling the people of Corinth, you are going to rule the world, and also you're going to rule angels. How many angels will you rule over? I don't know, but they will. What can an angel do? The work of a million men? A billion men? You're going to rule over them. Sam Carrillo is going to have a million angels at his command, and you will too. I don't know. I'm just making that up. We don't know. I don't know how many angels Sam Carrillo will be ruling over, but he's going to be ruling over some angels. That's mind-boggling. That's power that is invested in all of us. Do you see yourself there? That's where you'll be ruling. You'll be ruling the world, ruling angels. You'll have one city, 5 cities, 10 cities. and angels at your disposal to rule over. That's what they're here for. Hebrews says that they're ministering spirits, and they're sent to us. They're sent to the ones of God's elect. We may have been protected all our lives by angels. We may have had things happen for us that we never knew about. We may have entertained angels unaware. Oh, I think I had an angel over for dinner. No, probably not, because I don't know if you're supposed to ever find out if you did, but I don't know. Okay, not going to get into that. Do you see yourself there? Revelation 3 and verse 12. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. This is about the Philadelphian Aaron. By the way, no one that I've ever run into in the church says, I want to be in that Thyatira era. That's where I want to be raised up in. That's, you know, I've read through the evaluation. I want to be in Ephesus, losing my first love. I want to be in Sardis with dead works. No, nobody wants to be there, right? Everybody wants to be in Philadelphia. Everybody thinks they're in Philadelphia. I hope you are, and I hope I am too. But it says of this era, or this church, and some people don't believe in eras, so we won't even go into that, but let's just say that you belong in Revelation 3:12, no matter what you think. Put yourself there. It says that you're going to be a pillar in the temple of God, and he shall go out no more. What does that mean? I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes out of heaven from God, and I will write on him my new name. Three times for emphasis, new name, God. You're going to be named the God family. You're going to be a pillar in the temple of the God family. You're going to be at the heart and the center and the core. The establishment of God's kingdom begins with the first resurrection, of which you will be a part of, and you will be in that temple. And you'll never have any reason to go out. The gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable, as Paul said in Romans. According to ancient history, Philadelphia was the site of numerous earthquakes, so being a stable pillar in the temple, one that would not fail, and they didn't have a temple that the Christians went to in Philadelphia, so even then, John knew that this was an allegory, this was a symbol of something else. It wasn't a physical temple. I mean, they knew of Greek temples, but they weren't, I'm sure, meeting in a Greek temple. Well, wait a minute, we're meeting in a hall here, a Masonic lodge. I don't know, maybe they did, who knows? But the idols, as Paul taught them, meant nothing. But the point is, being a stable pillar in the temple, one that would never fail, was of inestimable, was of great value. God has called us to be immovable, unshakable pillars, knowing what we know, living by what we know, without any doubt about the plan of God, what it's offering to mankind. And we'll never, ever leave that kingdom. That's what this verse means. We will never want to. We will never be in a position to leave the most sacred part of God's holy temple. It's a position of honor, integrity, and respect, and will be for all time. But it's the epitome of the closeness of a family. Point number two, we are the priesthood, or we are a priesthood. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. In ancient times, the priesthood was entrusted with the law of God, and several times in the Bible it records that that priesthood failed. Sometimes they succumbed to bribes. Sometimes they took advantage of their position. And there are several times in which we find that God just killed them because it was so important that the priesthood represent God and his law in the most sacred manner possible. Sends a message to us. We are a priesthood as well, because the calling is high, the expectations are high, the standards of our priesthood are very high. And if you're going to be an unshakable, immovable pillar in the temple of God, mixing the metaphors, but it's symbolic language, you've got to be a high priest. You've got to be a priest in that priesthood, which is not going to succumb. but is going to do everything possible to uphold the standard of that priesthood. The book of Hebrews was written for the new covenant priesthood, for us. It's a beautiful book. It's complex yet subtle. It's very detailed in some areas, but basically it gets across the message that there has been a transition, and a necessary transition that has been made from the priesthood of Aaron and the sons of Levi, from Melchizedek back to Melchizedek. And that priesthood is the one that you are a part of today. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 10 through 16 says, "We have an altar from which those who serve in the tabernacle have no right to eat." This is explained a little bit earlier in the letter. The altar of this spiritual temple is something that Christians can go to on a daily basis. And Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 14 through 16 show us that we have a right to that altar. We have a right to that forgiveness and mercy and grace in time of need. And it's always available, not just one time a year as the case of the Levitical priesthood, but all the time, 24/7, never failing us. This is an altar where the sacrifices were offered. I think one of the most beautiful of all sacrifices, and they're all beautiful, but the one that is most represented by this, the sacrifice of the peace offering, or the saving offering, as it is also called. The peace offering was shared by the priest, the offerer, and God, no matter what kind it was. It was without blemish, therefore typifying no sin. It was also a sweet-smelling savor because a portion of it was offered on the altar, and it was burnt, and it was, you know, the kidneys and the fat and everything piled on it, and all of it was accepted by God. And it was the only offering in which all three individuals participated, God, priest, and man, foreshadowing the time that Revelation 21 and 22 talks about when it shows that we will be in New Jerusalem, God, priest, all of mankind, Jesus Christ, the Father, and everyone together in this enormous family that God is creating. Verse 11, "For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. We must go to him. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come." The city, of course, is New Jerusalem. It's the city of God, the one that doesn't have any dimensions. It's a spiritual city that we seek, and that's the city that those in Hebrews 11 sought after as well. "Therefore, by him let us continually offer," by that high priest. You know, we work with our high priest as members of the priesthood of God. "Let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." We are given that authority and that power now because we are the priesthood of God right now, because we can do this now. Even as you're sitting in your chair, you can pray to God. You have access to God, as we learn through the Day of Atonement. Only the high priest in Israel could go to this altar, could go to the Holy of Holy areas one time a year, and only him. We have that opportunity and that power invested in us right now. Now, how much power can one person do? Well, there is, I won't mention any names, but there is a member of one of our congregations in the West Coast, let's put it that way, that everyone knows that this individual has answered prayers on basically a weekly basis. This individual is an older woman, and she is known for a pretty high success rate. But the one thing, whether her prayers are answered in exactly the way that, you know, we hope for, that are visible or not, we do know this, that she does pray for a lot of people. That is a power that God has invested in all of us. "So therefore, by him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. But do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. Now is the time. You know, well, it's fresh on your mind. Just got back from the feast, rejuvenated like crazy. Everybody is. Everybody I talked to in Sierra Vista, everybody I briefly spoke to here, had a great feast. Now is the time as priests to connect with God. Any of you ever watched Sesame Street? I mean, who could avoid it if you've had kids? I mean, I'm not saying it's great, but I have a little rhyme. Which one of these doesn't look like the other, or something like that? Do you remember that? Okay, point three. This one kind of doesn't look like the other two. We got temple and priesthood, trees. We are trees. Doesn't sound like it belongs, right? Which one of these doesn't? Well, let me explain. It kind of does belong. We are trees. Point number three. Psalm 1 and verse 1 says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the paths of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be a tree, like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper." From the time of the Garden of Eden, trees have been used symbolically to show either eternity or man's way, which is temporary. Trees can be symbolic of eternal righteousness and God's graciousness, or symbolic of man's choice in his kingdom. And it's found throughout the Bible. You'll find trees mentioned throughout the Bible. You'll find them in the Gospels. You'll find them in a number of different instances in which Christ gave parables and told them. And trees are also used as kind of bookends in Genesis and then in Revelation. And it says in Revelation 22 that there will be a stream of life, and there will be trees for the healing of the nations, which is kind of a mystical thing, because if the nations, by context, are already in the kingdom of God, why will they need to be healed? Well, the explanation that I have come up with for that is that you're not going to be stagnant forever. Your sins will all be forgiven once they're forgiven and repented of. But can God allow and help his family to grow throughout all eternity? My answer is yes. And I think that's what it's drawing our attention to. In Daniel chapter 4 and verse 10, you'll remember this vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, where he said, "These are the visions of my head. While on my bed I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth. And its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heaven dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it." The kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar is characterized, as a tree also. But it's a false kingdom with false values by, you know, a dictator who certainly was bloodthirsty in many ways. But under its limbs and branches, all the other nations of the earth came, because it was the first world ruling kingdom, succeeded by other ones, which all had their own types of part of the tree, even though this Babylonian tree was cut down and defeated by the Persians. It seems to be good because there are a lot of good things associated with it. And all man's systems at some point seem to be good to somebody, seem to be beneficial for somebody, and yet they all fail. They all are problematic. And this one is personified by a beastly nature, as we know. But it looks good. And everything in this world can look good or be made to look good. But contrast that with Psalm 92 and verse 12, which says, "The righteous shall flourish like a palm tree. He shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Those that are planted in the house of the Lord shall flourish in the court of our God." Now, that's part of the temple. You know, trees going to be around the temple, going to be there. But trees are only a symbol of something else, because we know them of something that can provide shade and can provide nourishment in the form of fruit and can provide harmony in the environment. It could do so much good. We just don't have a whole lot of them in this town. We have some. You're kind of startled when you fly over Tucson. You see there are a lot of trees there, but there are more than one story I've had of people that have gone to other feast sites where they said, wow, it was so green back in block there, that other site. Certainly green in Maui to some extent. Anyway, sorry. The tree that is being spoken of in this verse is the date palm. Now, date palms are familiar to some people who drive from here to California, and they even sell date palm milkshakes in some places. Maybe it's Stuckey's or some, you know, it used to be a place you'd find every 100 miles on highways in the United States. I think there's probably two left in the United States, and one of them is in the California-Arizona border, I think. Maybe not. Anyway, the date palm milkshake didn't sound really great to me, but they actually make milkshakes with date palms as an addition. Seems like a good way to ruin vanilla ice cream, if you ask me. But anyway, the date palm of the Middle East had more uses than there were days in the year. They did everything with the date palm. You could eat the fruit. You could dry it and preserve it. You could make honey out of it. You could make liquor out of the honey that they make from the date palm. It's a nectar, actually. They can use the leaves and make thread from the leaves and thread from various parts of the trunk and everything. They just have a multitude of uses. And the same thing is true with God's trees, those that he is planting within his kingdom. And you have been planted within God's kingdom. Into the kingdom we are given as examples that the nations will need to follow. They will need the shelter, the stability, the fruit that is offered by God's people, God's trees. Nebuchadnezzar, not a good tree. You, all of you, good trees. Trees of righteousness to which the peoples of the earth will come and flock and learn and grow and be sheltered and will be protected for all the 1,000 years. Revelation 22, verses 1 and 2 say, he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of the street and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. These are symbols of purity, righteousness, and the enduring power of God's healing forever and ever. Brethren, we are a temple. Those are the powers that God has invested in you right now. We are a priesthood. Again, powers that God has invested in you immediately. We are also trees of righteousness. Do you see yourself in these symbols? I think you do. I hope you do, because you're there already. That's what God expects of you, and that's what you will be in the world tomorrow.